Hello, I'm Matt Carpenter, and this is the Good Life Podcast.
Hello, this is Matt, and I'm glad you could join us today on the Good Life Podcast. Today, I have Nathan Gill with me. Nathan is an educator, a writer. He graduated from Hillsdale College, very familiar to many of us. And he is the academic dean of Chapel Field Christian School in New York, where he was New York State, the Hudson Valley, where he also is a husband and a father of three young children. Nathan, thank you for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for the invitation.
Several weeks ago, I read an article. Became acquainted with Nathan reading an article that he wrote for the American Reformer called Towards a More American Classical Education. And it interested me because I've had thoughts along some of these lines before, having taught for a long time, and I appreciated a lot of what you have to say. But just to start with, you have a background in classical education, certainly, you know, having gone to Hillsdale. So just, you know, talk about your background. What is it that interested you, that motivated you to go into classical education?
Yeah, well, yeah, thanks for that introduction. I was homeschooled, so my parents were pretty early on there in the early 90s, jumping on board the whole homeschooling train, and they homeschooled my brothers and I. And so I was homeschooled in rural New York State, and I got some elements of a classical education there in that environment. So not fully. We did, you know, curriculum here and there, but my mom was great at, we read a lot of mythology, we read a lot of fairy tales, we read a lot of classic stories, and really got like kind of the literary side of a classical education. Came to love the history of Greece and Rome and the Middle Ages through having great hero stories told. So really enjoyed that, and that went a long way towards giving me a love of history. And then when I went through college, I studied history, but I did college online so that I could work. I worked at a small museum in Cooperstown, New York, which kind of deepened my love of history. I then worked in politics actually for a year for a freshman congressman who was elected during the Tea Party elections. And I worked for him as a kind of a local representative in a small office for about a year. And it was a good experience in a lot of ways, but it brought me face to face with the depth of the cultural problem we're facing in this country. And I remember kind of being torn between politics and other things I wanted to do, and a lot of the hopes that I'd had for what politics could accomplish in 2010. The more I talked to constituents, the more I was impressed by just how our education system had failed to equip them with basic civic knowledge. So that really impressed itself upon me. Ended up going to graduate school, got into Hillsdale, which was a great blessing, and their approach to education, primary sources, reading the classics, was hugely impactful on me, and also helped me to kind of wrestle with the question of the relationship between the United States and the American Republican experiment and its connection to the classics, which that relationship, some would call it a tension, I don't know, just was something that I thought a lot about, and me and my classmates talked a lot about. And then kind of from Hillsdale, I decided I was still kind of torn between going into politics and education, and I decided just there was so much energy at Hillsdale kind of around alternative ways of educating with the charter school movement and the classical school movement that I was just kind of caught the infectious enthusiasm and really came to see kind of in the circumstances we're living in the 21st century. Education is maybe in a way it's good for its own sake, but in another way too, to me it seems like the most politically necessary thing at the moment. So I definitely don't think of classical education as primarily a partisan thing by any means. I think it is about the good, the true, and the beautiful. But on the other hand, it does have, and my article I guess gets into this, but I really do believe that it has a political dimension to it that's unavoidable. You're forming citizens, and that's a constant presence in the literature and the tradition on education. And actually, that's one of the critiques I guess I would have about some of the organizations and leaders in the classical movement right now, is just when you hear all the talk about the good, the true, and the beautiful, which I wholly embrace, and I love that. When you go back and read Aristotle, Book 8, about the purpose of education in a regime, and when you go back and read Luther, his letter to the Christian nobility on establishing public schools, what surprises you is how politically these guys were thinking.
Yes.
And I think that there's something there that the classical movement right now needs to recover. So that's kind of how I got to where I am right now.
That is a very interesting perspective. I think it's easy to read back. In talking to people, we have so many historical blind spots. And usually, for blind spots, if it's something we admire, we fill it in with whatever we consider wonderful and lovely. So, in an age of political turmoil, which I'm not convinced that there hasn't been an age bereft of political turmoil, then you are faced with, well, people look back and they see an era and they think, wow, wouldn't it be great if we could all just sit under Plato at the academy? Or if we could sit under C.S. Lewis at Oxford, or Tolkien, whoever you want in between. But they all are dealing with significant problems. I mean, Plato was seeing the end of Greek civilization as he knew it. It was beginning to crumble. Or Augustine, seeing the same. I mean, the City of God is one of the most overtly, not solely political, but it is a political document. The first half is a deconstruction of the Roman way. So there's no lily white ethereal classical movement that we can say, oh, this is what we want. Like I read one conservative, no. One classical educator, a writer well known in the classical movement, recently said that there is nothing inherently conservative about the classical education. And I thought, methinks thou dost protest too much.
Yes, and I would agree. Actually, you mentioned, it's interesting, you mentioned Lewis. And of course, yeah, Plato and Aristotle, what are they teaching and philosophizing in the shadow of? They are, you know, it's it's the Peloponnesian Wars, the breaking apart of Greece. It is the Macedonian conquest of Greece. And they're both working in those contexts, profoundly political. And when you look at the people Socrates is talking to in his dialogues, he's talking to, oftentimes, it's many people, but he's often singling out people like Glaucon, who are among the elite. He's concerned about the soul, primarily, and he's wanting to expose the problems in Glaucon's soul in the Republic. But on the other hand, he definitely is interested in reaching Glaucon also because of Glaucon's political significance. So there's an unescapable political dimension. And Lewis, one of my favorite little essays by Lewis that I think about a lot, and I wonder if you've read, is Learning in Wartime.
Yes.
In the Weight of Glory collection. And what Lewis's point there is, he's absolutely affirming that, you know, we could say education for its own sake, that we're supposed to be seeking these transcendent goods, but he's also saying this is always going to happen under the shadow of earthly chaos.
Yes.
political rivalry, civil war, and he's saying that literally as World War II was beginning on the continent, and he had students who were already in the army fighting in France and Belgium while he was addressing that class with those words.
Yes, and now remind me, does he have another essay about living in an atomic age?
He does, and I'm not as familiar with that one. I don't think I've read that one.
So I believe there's a lot of overlap in the two essays. But in living in an atomic age, there's always, you know, so it was written after learning in wartime. But he's saying, we live in a time when we could be destroyed at any given time, you know, and there's not much we can do about it. So we have a choice. Either we can live in panic or we can continue doing the things that men and women have always done. And, you know, for him, it was to give himself to the work of education. And again, I know there was overlap between the two, but his just overall consistency in keep on, plod, do what you need to do, and don't worry about all the things that could happen.
Right.
So I appreciated that a lot.
Yes, yeah, I did as well. And even though he doesn't address this in Learning in Wartime, I think there's a kind of implicit critique in there that you can find of people who try to overly, as you put it, etherealize education. Because even though Lewis is, of course, is the defender of the medieval vision of education and the good, the true, and the beautiful, and the soul as the end, at the same time, he, in Learning in Wartime, he talks about how education is about preparing us to do our duties. He talks about the charwoman, you know, even a simple charwoman, and how she should be educated and enabled to do her duty to her utmost so that she can glorify God in her vocation. It's not just something that we do, you know, sitting around sipping martinis and enjoying leisure, although that's an element of it.
Sure.
It's something that's inescapably attached to action and duty as well. And that's why I love the earlier writers in the tradition, like Luther gets this, Aristotle gets this, so many others get this, that they're a very significant component of classical education has always been about equipping you to do your duty.
Right, right. The gifts of grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric are not to simply have fencing contests in front of large crowds where you can receive their adulation. But words are gifts to be used in the battle that we face.
Precisely.
And, I mean, even so, thinking back to the prophets in the Old Testament, they were using their words to speak against the nations who opposed Israel and later Judah, but also used against the wicked leaders of Israel and Judah herself, you know, well, with both of them, that when you are going out of the right way, you need someone to call you back. And the wiser you are, the more experienced you are in knowing how to properly use grammar and properly use your language, rhetoric, and everything else, you will be better able to oppose those who are in the wrong.
Absolutely. Yeah, and which is not to say that knowing grammar and logic and rhetoric isn't also about enabling us to delight in words themselves and the pleasure of just a good leisurely conversation, but it is at least equally about equipping us to do battle in the war of words,
right?
And to fight. I mean, Aristotle in the Politics talks about how speech is the distinctive characteristic of a human being because it's how our reason is expressed. And what is the purpose of speech for him? The purpose of speech is to set forth the advantageous, the disadvantageous, the just, the unjust, to enable us to pursue what is good.
Yes.
And part of that is fighting for what is good as well.
Right. So to see education as preparation for battle is a good way to look at it. Now, of course, you have some who think that the only reason you have that you learn is just so you can fight all the time and inflame others. Well, there's also the... I think of someone like Aragorn from Lord of the Rings, who serves as a king. He is a gifted fighter. I mean, before he's a king, when he is just... He protects the area, and he serves the Fellowship. He is a very experienced fighter. But the note that many forget in that book is he is also a healer. He uses his gifts to heal, and he's experienced in that. He's wise in knowing how to heal. So one must, our words, the Apostle Paul says, let no corrupting communication come from your mouth. So that which just makes something implode, that which disintegrates should not come out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that which builds up instead. So anyway, I mean, I know that that's, you don't talk about this in the article, but these are all important elements.
No, but it's for sure. Well, I love what you're saying there. That's a great point. I mean, and for Tolkien, I think when you first read Lord of the Rings, the whole thing about Aragorn as the healer makes no sense. And then when you start to see what he's doing there, it really is so crucial to his vision for what a king is, what a good, dare I say, Christian king is. So I think for the person who only uses the trivium and the other arts for battle, I think what you're missing there, and very similar to the point you're making, is that I think Aristotle would push back and say, well, what is the end? What are you working towards? It's kind of like his critique of Spartan society in the Politics, where they're so engaged in the work of preparing for war that they forget that you prepare for war in order to have peace.
Right.
You have to know how to be able to handle peace as well, because peace is the ultimate aim for which you're fighting. And I think with the war of words and the temptation that some people can have to overly stress the liberal arts as preparation for battle, as we're saying, I guess I would push back, I think, as Aristotle would, and say, to what end? The end here is to have agreement and to be able to enjoy with our words the world that God has created.
Yes.
It's persuasion and battle, if we must, for the end of enjoyment.
Yes. But that does give you, I mean, when you have the proper end in mind, you can pursue, even in your, when two different sides who disagree on a particular point. So take the American War for Independence. The way that they engage, and I'm not saying that there were not sins committed by both sides, but in general, when you consider the way that the war was fought, King George III could have called for his troops to wage war in a much harsher, much more just torched earth manner, and could have won had they taken a win the war at all cost mindset versus, and this is in the recent biography of George III, the author points this out, and I cannot remember the name of the author right now, but he points out that they did not wage that war in the same way that they put down other uprisings in other colonies, because they viewed the Americans as Englishmen. They had a respect for them. And so, taking that into our discussion, when we use our, when we view those that we are speaking, to whom we are speaking, as themselves, our fellow men, as mutual citizens, mutual parts of God's world, it will change the way that we engage with them. Doesn't mean that we will not fight and there will not be, or, you know, how, whatever that looks like, but you don't get to brutalize those. Again, and that comes from having the proper purpose in mind, the proper end in mind.
Yeah, I think that's something that I, that's something that you, you run into in the classroom often, the difference between how to persuade versus manipulate students. And I really am grateful to Andrew Kern from the Searcy Institute for the way he always emphasizes the distinction between the Socratic mode of trying to entice and attract somebody to your point of view versus, as he puts it, pulling them towards you with a hook through the nose.
Right.
And with our students, it can be tempting, especially when you're trying to go fast and people are misbehaving, to use threats and enticements to get them to listen to you, but it's so much better to appeal to their soul, to appeal to their moral sense and their moral imagination.
Yes.
So absolutely. Yeah, and I think something that our conversation is kind of stirring in me too is one thing that really motivates me in the article, and then in the other work that I do, is I've been really influenced by, I don't know if you've read any Roger Scruton.
Yes.
But
yes.
I've been influenced by his way of seeing education as the transmission of a way of life as well. a handing over from one generation to the next,
mm-hmm.
Not just of ideas, but as a way of life. That's something that I think is very much there in the background of my article, as our American way of life fragments and degrades and disappears. The way that classical education, I think, done well, can really help in, especially in Christian community, to help hand over that tradition. As the Latin root of that word suggests, to hand it down from one to the other. And it's something I care profoundly about, because I think a lot of my early memories and thoughts, I mentioned to you before the podcast that my grandparents had kind of a classic New England-style farmhouse in northern New York, and a lot of my early memories are from romping around in the fields and the woods around there. And it wasn't, by the time I was a kid, it was just a small farm. It was basically a hobby farm. But all around the area in the last, growing up, I've just seen farming and attachment to the land and the way of life that I so loved and saw in my grandparents just kind of disappearing from rural New York. My county used to be one of the number one, I think it was the number one producer of milk in New York State at one time, and now it's just a formerly agricultural wasteland of a lot of unemployed people, and unfortunately gigantic, one of the biggest employers is the social services in the county. And it's a profoundly sad thing on a number of levels, but I'm very attracted to this idea of using the liberal arts not just to equip and shape people who can fulfill their duties, but also to hand over a way of life from one generation to the next.
That is that view itself is one that Scruton received from, I know Edmund Burke speaks that mm-hmm. way in his reflections on the Revolution in France, G.K. Chesterton, and of course there's many in between those two, but it's that's really what discipleship is intended to be, is a way of handing down what we have received from our fathers in the faith. It's not an ideological, let me drain you of all the other stuff you've received, and I'm going to pour, you know, I'm going to fill you up with my thinking. It's cliched, but passing the baton, essentially. But it's more than just a baton. It's a life-giving way to them.
Yes. I love that whole vision of education. It's so much more. I love that you compared it to discipleship, because I think when you understand the classical education traditionally, it looks so much like Paul's letters in a lot of ways, and the way that Paul emphasizes the handing over and the way that he goes between his rhetoric, the different ways that he appeals to the churches, and it's a beautiful thing. And even some of the etymology of the words that we use, I'm indebted here to Christopher Perrin from Classical Academic Press for the way that he emphasizes, you know, when you get right down to the Latin roots of some of these words we use, like assess, an assessment. What could be more impersonal than a modern day assessment, right? We think of standardized tests and, you know, number two pencils and filling in circles and that kind of thing. And he makes the point that if you get right down to the original Latin roots of that word, it means to sit beside somebody. That assessment at one time was a teacher and a pupil having a conversation about what was good, true, and beautiful.
Yes.
And that's something that I think is, in the classroom, I've just seen the need for schools. The more that they can shrink class sizes, the more they can give one-on-one time between teachers and students, the more that they can make space for that kind of personal interaction. Not only does it make for better assessment in our sense and better examination of what people know, but it makes for that relational aspect as well that I think has always been so foundational to a real education. Because what is the nature of education ultimately? It's becoming like your teacher.
Yeah.
That's the goal. We don't always like to admit that, but that is when you entrust your children to a teacher, what you are doing, whether you like it or not, is saying, we want you to become more like this person.
Yeah. Well, and
In their frailty and their fallenness and everything, but hopefully their virtues and their knowledge preeminently.
Yes. Well, I've been not surprised exactly, but in some ways I just did not realize how often Paul speaks in a way that where he calls people to imitate himself. In the famous passage where he talks about, you know, in Philippians 4, the one that, you know, so many people know, when he says whatever things are true, honest, just, pure, lovely, of good report, virtuous, if there's any praise, think on these things. Many people are familiar with that verse, but they're not familiar with the verse immediately following where he says those things which you have both learned and received and heard and seen in me, do. And the God of peace will be with you. So he's not just commending them to a bunch of abstract concepts. He's not just saying, you know, think about flowery fields and beautiful sunsets and the lake waters lapping. He's saying, think on these right and righteous and, yes, good and true and beautiful things, but then tangibly, those same things, the things that are good that you have observed in me, that's what you should practice. So he never separates. I mean, truth and beauty and goodness are never these ideals that hover.
Absolutely.
In some pure Platonic form. They're always incarnational. And what one of the, right, the beautiful things that Augustine's Christian Platonism ideas, that it gives embodiment to the forms in a wonderful way.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's, I'm so glad you brought up the word imitation, because there are few words I think that are so bound up in just what education, especially, and the classical tradition gets this, and I really want to commend classical schools here for doing such a good job of getting this central insight that in a world, you know, where we try to put the cart before the horse, we encourage kids even in elementary school to express themselves and to write free form essays and give their opinions and their thoughts, when really the classical insight has always been imitate greatness, and only through imitating greatness will you eventually have something worthy to say, something of your own. So that is so important. And I think what you're saying about embodiment and incarnational, I get at that a little bit in the article. And I think your point that truth, goodness, and beauty, at least on this side of eternity, are always incarnated, I think is so crucial, because I guess one of the critiques I have had, where I think classical schools that I have observed anyway could do better, is just recognizing how much of the truth, goodness, and beauty we talk about abstractly needs to be apprehended in our own tradition, which is not to exclude other traditions, which is not to exclude certainly Western tradition, or even in some cases others as well. But preeminently, again, we're Americans. We are inheritors of a certain heritage that's been handed down, and our heritage and our nation has blind spots, and that's why we need classical education, because studying antiquity is going to help us see blind spots that we can all admit our tradition and our nation has. At the same time, I think there's so much of truth, goodness, and beauty, and righteousness, and all these other wonderful forms, to use the Platonic word, that we can access through our own tradition, that's made for us, that's understandable to us in a way that it's not understandable to anybody else, and it's there often, and we neglect it more than we should, I feel.
Yes. Well, getting into your article itself, part of the strong emphasis that you make here is something that I've thought about, and Amanda, my wife, and I we've talked about this, and that is that in some places, with the recent rebirth in this generation of classical Christian education, there is a lack of emphasis on the particular. There are these, it's an idea of this universal Greek, Roman, and Christian books that come together, and that we're to remain focused on those things. But that's not where we live. And frankly, that's not entirely who we are. I mean, certainly they help, they're much further upstream than we are, and they contributed to the river that we find ourselves standing in. But there's a lot more to this river than those people who are 100 miles upstream.
Sure.
So unpack that some. And what does an American, how would an American, flavor is not a good way to say it, but an American emphasis in classical education, what does that potentially look like, or what does it entail?
Sorry, I think service blipped out or something. I didn't hear that last few seconds.
What does an American classical education look like for, you know, that something that's not abstract, but that has tangible, particular emphasis that includes,
sure,
things like, you know, I know you could say we just have an American history class, but that's not the only thing you're going for in the article.
Right. Yeah, no, it's certainly not just American history. I don't even think it's just the humanities. It's easiest to see it there, that what could be done with American literature classes and other literature classes to incorporate more strategically the American sources alongside the other worthy books. But I think it's even something ultimately, and this is not my strong suit, so I don't have a lot of great thoughts here. I think it's even something that's got to color how you teach STEM. And I'd be fascinated to have somebody more knowledgeable than myself flesh out what that looks like. But
Say that again. You actually cut out right there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I was saying that I think it's something that doesn't just color your humanities classes, but also STEM classes as well. And I would love to see somebody who knows STEM, unlike myself, who is more classically educated than myself, to unpack what that looks like in STEM classes, what a more an education in science and math does for American citizens, specifically. So there's a few things here. I think first of all, there's the obvious points, many of which I make in the article, that when we're selecting from the canon, the Western canon of great texts, we should absolutely be reading the classics from our larger Western tradition, the Greeks, the Romans, the medievals, and even in some cases beyond. But even there, one of the points I make in the article is there's such an infinite variety within the Western canon to choose from that just saying read the Western canon often isn't that. I'm the academic dean of my school, so I'm involved with curriculum choices. And I know the pain that curriculum developers can face when they're trying to select, out of all these great books, they're trying to select what their students need to know. And one of my points is, even when you're choosing from medieval and classical sources, I think you should be choosing from them with American aims in mind. For instance, I'll give you one easy example, because you mentioned before you were recording that you've been teaching your kids Plutarch. Plutarch is so, not only is there a universal quality to Plutarch, where he's just an amazing writer, but he's so widely known and revered by not only the entire founding generation, but by Americans really until the last 80 years. I mean, he was one of President Truman's favorite writers, believe it or not. to understand the United States, you cannot understand the United States without Plutarch.
Yes.
I think I'd be bold enough to say. I was just listening to a podcast that one of my friends was on talking about education for the American regime. This is Dr. Clifford Humphrey, who's a former classmate of mine and has done a lot of good work on education. And he was pointing out that Benjamin Rush, who has this magnificent essay on how Americans should be educating their citizens, I linked to it briefly in my article, but a fascinating, fascinating essay with so many great points that we're surprised to hear a founding father say, including kind of a bit of a rabbit trail here, I suppose, but including he thinks that not only should your education try to prejudice your students in favor of Republican government and in favor of Christianity, he even says that public education in the United States should be working to promote denominational affiliation, which is fascinating. nothing that you would hear, you know, that's not a magnet on any public school teacher's refrigerator these days.
Right.
but my point is, Rush, my friend Cliff points out that Rush extensively is drawing from Plutarch, even in that essay.
Right.
His thoughts about the education that fits the American regime, he's drawing not just on Plutarch, he's thinking as an American in light of the Enlightenment and his Protestant faith, but he is extensively engaging, particularly with the life of Lycurgus by Plutarch. So I think thinking about our own national tradition, I think, helps us choose from the wider Western tradition the texts to privilege over the others, because we have such a finite amount of time with our students that we need something beyond just the Western canon as a guide to selecting text. So there's that. And then I'll just make another couple quick points, then turn it back to you. But I think that another way that this needs to be, another thing that classical educators need to double down on, is especially, as funny as this may sound, an American aesthetic. Beauty is so crucial to forming the soul. And this is something that classical tradition really understands well, and classical schools really understand well. But again, often I look at the classical schools, and they're doing a far better job than any other schools, but I see often students who wonderfully can talk about Rembrandt and Vermeer and Michelangelo. And the American aesthetic is often underrepresented, and there is a such thing as the American aesthetic. A lot of the great 19th century American artists were consciously trying to create one because they understood that a particular aesthetic tradition produces certain kinds of people. So I love, just an amateur interest, I love American architecture and 19th century American art. And I think there's a lot of wisdom there in great artists like Thomas Cole, who's probably the greatest American artist in my opinion, and his engagement with what American art should be in some of his published and unpublished writings and his paintings. And then Winslow Homer, another great, and I'm biased, but particularly the Hudson River School that Thomas Cole kind of inaugurates is so influential in forming the notion in the 1800s and beyond of the kinds of beauty and the kinds of imagination that American citizens need to be self-governing.
Yes.
And then the final point, just very quick, would just be the point I make in the article is that I think an American education really needs to lean into the wisdom of our tradition that refuses to see a dichotomy between the practical arts, the manual arts, what Hugh of St. Victor calls the mechanical arts, the arts that require the hands. I think we really need to double down on seeing the mutually beneficial relationship between the arts that develop the hands, so to speak, craftsmanship, and the liberal arts that develop the mind.
Yeah.
I think the two are mutually reinforcing, and one of the great insights of the Protestant tradition, and specifically, I would say, Protestantism in the United States, I think one of the great contributions has been seeing the marriage of those things and not giving into the siren call of classical antiquity, or even sometimes, I would say, the overly contemplative strain of other Christian traditions that tries to force more of a separation between those two families of the arts.
Right, right. There's the... Boy, I'm having to organize my thoughts so they don't all come out at once. But...
Sorry, that was a lot.
but it was really good. I think of someone when you talk about architecture, like Christopher Alexander, architectural historian. He wrote several books on, like, he has a four-volume work, and I have to save up pennies over about 10 years and then buy one of them. it's called The Nature of Order. It's a four-volume series, but it's on looking at art. The subtitle is an essay on the art of building and the nature of the universe. But he also wrote about specific American forms of architecture. One of his books is called A Timeless Way of Building, and he looks at a lot of American methods of building, and he just talks about what is it that makes this beautiful? Why are people drawn to this? And he goes into a lot of detail on that. So he's one example of someone who I appreciate. I mean, he can be very dense and abstract, but also he can bring it down to a particular level and help people to look at things. Because, you know, granted, we don't have nearly as many cathedrals here. But, you know, I think somebody like Ralph Adams Cram, who's up from your way, actually.
Yeah, I'm familiar with him, actually.
Who, in the early 1900s, he was an architectural designer, and he designed buildings and cathedrals. He was an Anglican, a high church Anglican. And so there are, he would take some of the best of the medieval style, but also he would add modern elements to it and have this really interesting and beautiful version of architecture that it reflected. I mean, it was not just bringing Notre Dame here, but it was taking principles that are timeless, but also putting them into our own context. So, and again, this is just one area of you know, sure, someone who can do that very well.
That's fascinating. Actually, funny enough, I have a friend. So up in my home county, which is central New York State, very randomly, there is a tiny little church that Ralph Adams Cram designed for a family that had an estate there. And I have a friend who's the pastor of that church.
Oh, really?
So I know a little bit about Cram, actually. He's one of those great Bostonian architects. But I'm fascinated by him and the neo-Gothic revival. Something I don't care for about Cram is that he's very critical of my beloved Greek revival tradition. He has no patience for the early 19th century farmhouses with Greek details and proportions. But I'll forgive him that because he created beautiful churches.
Not everybody's perfect. He did write some good ghost stories, I will say. I love the combination of someone who can design beautiful things, but also who can write things that make your spine tingle slightly.
I haven't read his stories, but I came across that. It's fascinating.
So
I think the whole architectural thing is such a kind of a fertile source for even understanding how does an American appropriate the classical tradition, because I love, like I said, I love a lot of the early, my real love is the early Greek revival, like 1830s, 40s, farmhouses, north and south. And one thing I find interesting, I was even thinking about this as I wrote my article, was the way that those often itinerant architects worked with the classical tradition. And what you find when you open those manuals is they spend a few chapters on laying out what the different Greek orders of architecture are, the four orders, Doric, Ionic, and so forth. And they talk about things like the proportions, right? Like the golden ratio and things like that. But what's fascinating to me about that is, so they're drawing on the classical tradition. They're referencing people like Vitruvius and the Parthenon and things like this. But then they immediately turn and unapologetically apply those principles to an American context where they're working with wood instead of with stone. And they're talking about farmhouses instead of temples. And I think there's something really interesting there, even for how they thought through their relationship between taking classical principles now, but unapologetically and clearly using it with American materials for American life.
Right. Right. That's a great way of learning to adapt. And
yes,
you know, as you were talking about things that are specifically American, I believe while we focus much of our classical education centers around Greek and Roman culture and their contributions, that America as we know it, due to especially those who migrated here from Northern Europe and from Britain, we do not yet value the Norse and far north Northern European emphasis, and how we don't value the contribution that culture has still on us today.
Yeah, there was some interesting conversation surrounding my article once it once it hit Twitter, and Lyman Stone, kind of a Lutheran, I think is a statistician, mm-hmm. but he works a lot with demographic data. He was talking about the opening that my article made for including more Norse and Germanic stuff. And I wouldn't take things quite as far as he did, because I do think the Greco-Roman nature of the tradition, the founding fathers are far more influenced by Greece and Rome than they are by ancient Germanic mythology. At the same time, if you look at the Whig theories about government and the emphasis they put on the ancient Anglo-Saxon constitution, there's clearly a lot of I think there is more that could be done with the Germanic roots of the English language and American history, kind of going back to, I think, to teach American history well and American literature in an American classical school, you do need to be intentional too about how you teach English and medieval English literature, because so much of that is preparatory for what comes after. It's hard to appreciate the Whig theory of government and the appeals to the Magna Carta without understanding something about Anglo-Saxon kingship, Alfred the Great, and what common law comes from,
right?
Ultimately,
right. I know several years back there was an article in Modern Age magazine by I think it's Christian Kopf, called The German Roots of American Order.
Okay.
And he details a lot of our, you know, the influence that is, yes, much more low-lying than Greek and Roman, but it's there. And anyway, there's so many different areas where you know you could take and try and apply what you've written about, but
yeah.
You know, it's helpful at least to free people. Your work is helpful that it frees people from thinking that there's one singular form that I must follow, I've got to study ancient Greece, ancient Rome, ancient Jerusalem, and then, you know, if I happen to get to the year 1600 by the time my child's graduated high school, that's, there's actually good things and important things about knowing who we are that we should learn, and parts of our culture, as you say, you know, the mechanical arts, which we didn't even get to, but that has a strong emphasis in the United States and has part of our original order. And even you mentioned entrepreneurship, which is definitely an American gift. That's something that we have always done really well here that is not touched usually in classical school. And this is not to bash classical schools. I don't mean that at all.
Sure.
But just these are things that that we have that we should not neglect simply because we're trying to recover what's been lost.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think it's crucial too, and I do want to put a plug in here for Aaron Wren's book. I'm sure many of your listeners have read it, but Life in the Negative World, because he's coming at it from a religious and I guess sociological perspective, but he says several times throughout the book just how crucial it is that however Christians do choose in their communities to educate their children, we've got to be doing better at preparing them, as he puts it, to face the conditions of modernity. Just the level of pressure that's going to be brought to bear on Christians, the mainline institutions increasingly being closed off to devout Christians, we're going to be kind of forced back to rely on our own resources more and more. And we need to be preparing our children and grandchildren to be thinking very entrepreneurially, not just for the sake of strategic thinking and fulfilling life, although certainly that, but in some cases too, although this makes it sound kind of dire, for the sake of survival,
right?
And for the sake of transmission of the faith. So I think it's absolutely crucial that that American ethos of, to put it kind of crassly, being a self-starter, entrepreneurial in your thinking, I think it's absolutely crucial that classical schools who do so well developing that on the character level, the virtues of self-governance and diligence, I think it's absolutely crucial that we connect the dots to help our students think through and help them get a leg up in doing that with their hands as well and with their plans after they graduate.
Yes. Well, Nathan, this has been really good, and I'll post a link to your article and hopefully to a few other as much as I can remember at least of different books and articles that we've talked about here. But it's helpful and it's beneficial for people who want this but are perhaps intimidated because again that they think that they have to become masters themselves before they can teach their kids, when most of the parents I know who do the best job are those who simply enjoy learning and they're just learning right along with their kids and they're not ashamed of it. So thank you for taking time to be with us today. It's been great.
No, it's been delightful. Thank you so much for having me. I've thoroughly enjoyed this and just pray that it's beneficial and get some good conversations going about how classical education can continue to mature and do what it does so well.
All right. Thank you very much.
The Good Life Podcast is a ministry of Trinity Reformed Church in Huntsville, Alabama. If you like this podcast, you might enjoy one of our other podcasts, Got a Minute, featuring Larson Hicks and Rich Luss. Theology, philosophy, economics, politics, and more for normal people.